We're studying in James chapter 5, and we continue here tonight with that. We're right now in verse 12 that we were looking at before, where he says, "But above all things, my brethren, swear not, neither by heaven, neither by the earth, neither by any other oath, but let your yea be yea, and your nay, nay, lest you fall into condemnation." When we started into that verse last time, we pointed out that it's not a very common statement that we find in God's Word where he says, above all things, and then tells us something. And we looked at a couple of other cases where he says that. And just to refresh, Colossians 3 verse 4 was one of those, 3 verse 14 was one of those, as well as 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 8, both of them being very similar in that they teach about the purpose that God has for us, that we are striving for that being complete in the love of God. And both of those passages there, Colossians 3:14, 1 Peter 4:8, when he says above all things, it is related to that. So those are the two other verses that are really identical to this and using that phrase in that manner. So we did note that Ephesians 6 and verse 16 says above all in regard to the context of the armor of God. So it's limited there when he's going through each of the parts of the armor of God and that whole armor. And the part that he says above all is that shield of faith in Ephesians 6, verse 16. So similar, but not quite like those two other passages, and also James 5 and verse 12 that's says above all things and has a broader context. It might be more difficult to see how James 5 and verse 12 ties into or lines up with those other two verses that put above all things the ultimate purpose of God that we're striving for. So everything else is a part of that or in keeping with that. But we can see how this will tie in when we study it carefully. So it's not something that's out of line or contradictory with those other passages. And as we dig into God's Word and look at it, we should be able to understand how that fits in with the overall purpose of God, particularly when he gives us the reason why he says not to swear. So we looked at some other verses that pertain to this subject, particularly in the Old Testament, where that was not forbidden. Now, we don't find a commandment in the Old Testament law for the people to swear an oath, and that's what this is talking about. But we do find in the law of Moses, and we looked before at Numbers chapter 30, verses 1 and 2, where if someone did swear an oath or make a vow, and that would be very, very similar, if not identical, but in such a case, what was the law there that God gave them? If they made a vow or swore an oath, what was the law? They had to keep it. So he didn't command them to swear or vow, but he did command them to keep what they vowed or swore. We also looked at Ecclesiastes 5, verses 1 through 6, where he teaches that important principle that ties in with exactly what he's teaching in James 5, 13. Let our words to be few, and cautioning against hastily uttering anything, and particularly a vow, because once uttered, then God would require that to be kept. And so it would be better not to put one under that obligation than to hastily do it and then be bound by it. He also warned against trying to claim it was a mistake. Well, it may have been a mistake, but that does not remove the obligation to be faithful to that oath or vow. Otherwise, God's going to be destroying the works of the hands of the ones who are not faithful to their word in that way. Psalm 15 and verse 4, where we closed last time, mentions a number of the qualities that God is going to be looking for and requiring those who will ultimately be with him in eternity. As he puts it at the beginning of Psalm 15, those who would dwell in his tabernacle or his holy hill. And one of those qualities that he mentions in verse 4, those that would keep their word to their own hurt. So being faithful to the point in following God's word, if one enters into, and we have, even if we aren't formally making a vow and we're forbidden from swearing oaths, as we can see, as we read in James 5:13, but we do make covenants and we make agreements, and when we do that, we are required by God to keep those things. We've got to be faithful. Faithfulness is a quality of God. When God says he's going to do something, is there any maybe about it? When he promises something, there's not. If he says yes, it's yes it will be, or no, it will be no. But whatever God promises to do, he's going to fulfill that faithfully always. Well, we need to be like God, and we need to be faithful, and that's something we're commanded to be. And if being faithful causes us to suffer affliction, and we're willing to endure affliction in order to be faithful and not then become unfaithful to relieve ourselves from whatever affliction being faithful might bring, well, that's a quality that God very much appreciates and is pleased with. We need to be like that. So we can see the application of faithfulness to any covenant that we're a part of, and we need to be faithful, even if it's to our own hurt, to be that way. That whatever we say, we're going to be faithful to that. So there are agreements or covenants that we enter into on that basis, and we have lots of those in our lives. The most important covenant, of course, is that of marriage, and we must be faithful to that for sure. We have lots of other covenants and agreements. Purchase something that we end up making payments on, like a car or a house or something, there's always a contract with those things, and we enter into an agreement that we're going to pay a certain amount every month for that. And well, we need to be faithful to that when we are entering into an agreement. So that's certainly one of the ways in which a Christian, by showing honesty and faithfulness, we will be standing out from and being a light in this world and the salt of it, because that's something that, at least in modern times, those are qualities that are becoming more and more rare, aren't they? But anyway, that principle of faithfulness will apply to those covenants. But when it comes to swearing an oath, God required that one who did swear an oath under the Old Testament law, that they would have to be faithful to that and keep it. Well, in the New Testament, he says don't do that. So it's not something we're told, well, make sure whatever you swear to, you're going to keep that. He says don't do it. So here's one place where there is a difference between the New Testament law, the law of Christ, versus the Old Testament. And in fact, that very contrast is made by Christ himself in the Sermon on the Mount, where this subject comes up in Matthew chapter 5. So we want to turn over there now and read verses 33 through 37, Matthew 5, 33 through 37. In this particular section of this Sermon on the Mount that starts in chapter 5 and runs through chapter 7, so it's three chapters long, the longest single body of information or a record of a sermon that our Lord taught that exists. So this is, we're going to find more from this than there is of any other that God preserved for us. So this is obviously a very important and contains much excellent teaching. These are things that we must understand to be able to please God. But in this fifth chapter, this section of the sermon, we know it opens with what is referred to as the Beatitudes, meaning the blessings. But not long after that, we get into this contrast between what the people had heard, and a lot of these things are references to the Old Testament law, where Christ makes a contrast between what they have heard in the Old Testament law with what he is teaching, what is his covenant, which is the new covenant. That really starts in verse 21, when he says, "You've heard that it was said by them of old time, thou shalt not kill, and whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment." Well, thou shalt not kill was one of the Ten Commandments. But Jesus said in verse 22, "But I say unto you that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment." So there's a higher standard in these teachings that Christ calls us to. It's a higher standard than what was under the law of Moses. And the same is also true when he gets down to verse 27. "You've heard that it was said by them of old time, thou shalt not commit adultery." So here's another one of the Ten Commandments that he brings up. Verse 28, "But I say unto you that whosoever looketh on a woman to lust after her hath committed adultery with her already in his heart." It's a higher standard that he's calling us to. So those examples are there. Then we get to the next one in verse 33 that we want to read now through 37. "Again, you've heard that it hath been said by them of old time, thou shalt not forswear thyself, but shalt perform unto the Lord thine oaths. But I say unto you, swear not at all, neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, nor by the earth, for it is his footstool, neither by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Neither shalt thou swear by thy head, because thou canst not make one hair white or black. But let your communication be yea, yea, nay, nay. For whatsoever is more than these cometh of evil." Now what he says in James 5:13 is right along with this, almost word for word, captured from those five verses that we just read there, Matthew 5:33-37. Well, this is an example of one of these places where it's not a quotation of a commandment from the Old Testament law, like "thou shalt not kill," "thou shalt not commit adultery," where he says, "You've heard that it has been said not forswear thyself, but shall perform unto the Lord thine oaths." Well, what's the reference in the Old Testament for that statement? If we're looking for that quotation from the Old Testament, where do we find that? Well, we're not. When he gets to the next part, well, verse 38 is the eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, which is part of the Old Testament law. But then a little bit further down in verse 43, you've heard that it's been said, thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy. Well, the first part is certainly a quotation. It's part of the second greatest commandment of the law, to love thy neighbor as thyself. The second part, though, thou shalt hate thine enemy. What's the quotation from that, from the Old Testament? Well, there's not going to be that that quotation there, just like there's not in verse 33, thou shalt not forswear thyself, but shalt perform unto the Lord thine oaths. Now, we did read in Numbers chapter 30 where the Lord said they had to keep their oaths and be faithful to them. But this exact statement that is there in verse 34 that was an ingrained tradition was not something that God commanded. Again, he did not command the swearing of oaths under the Old Testament law. But that was a common saying. So some of these common sayings they had were straight out of the Old Testament law. Some of them were partially there, and then there was some tradition also that was very common among them that were very familiar to their ears, that everybody said or thought or for the most part. But now he's going to show that that is not the standard that meets the teachings of Christ. So the saying was, don't forswear yourself, but perform to the Lord your oath, your oaths. So you can't just swear by yourself. You have to swear to the Lord. Well, that's was not a commandment. But what is Jesus' response to that in verse 34? What is the standard that is the teachings of Christ of the New Testament about swearing? And it's very plain right there in verse 34. But I say unto you, swear not at all. That's exactly what James 5 verse 13 also says. But above all things, he says for us not to swear. So is that the same or different than what Jesus said? Is James 5:13, the teachings there the same or different from what Jesus is teaching here in the Sermon on the Mount? It's identical. So why does Jesus say swear not at all? Now, how many people follow this commandment of Christ today? I mentioned last time when we started in this, this is almost one of the best. Even though law enforcement, they have machines, those polygraph machines they call lie detector tests, there is no machine that man has made that can scientifically prove a person is lying. But anybody, the closest thing that we probably have to that is when somebody swears that whatever they're saying is the truth. I mean, that's almost guaranteed to be a lie when people say that. But how many people they'll swear by whatever it is, they're by the Lord or by their mother's grave or whatever the words are. I mean, how many people will swear oaths? I mean, it's absolutely common. What does Jesus say? Don't do it. Okay, now it's not veering off topic to bring this up. Where will this affect us? In what situation will this likely affect us most of all? Is there any application of this that might affect us, where we might be invited, encouraged, borderline compelled to swear? What happens in a courtroom? Yeah, what do they tell you to do? Put your, which one do you raise? Your right hand. You put your left one. They have a Bible. Whether you put your left hand on a Bible and raise your right hand, and they tell you to swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So help you God. Well, how many people do that? Well, just about everybody. Now, there are some who, like us, and everybody should know this commandment, but if everybody knew what Christ taught and was trying to follow it, then who would put their right hand on the Bible and raise their left, or raise their right and put the left hand on the Bible and swear anything? We wouldn't. But what does the law allow us to do so that it's not a problem for us? We can affirm that we're going to do that. We can state that we will be speaking the truth. We can give an assurance, a promise that we're going to do that, an affirmation. That's what affirm means. So we can do that. Last summer, I had to do that twice in the space of a week, which I hope to, I hope not to have to repeat that again. But anyway, that just was. That was interesting. That's the way things go sometimes. But some of the other work that I do can bring situations like that. So anyway, I had to give testimony in a court case, so they swore me in as a witness. But I affirmed, and that's what I said. I affirm. So they asked me if I swore to do that, and I said I affirm. That's fine. So that we can say that and be agreeing that we are going to be speaking the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth, without swearing an oath, which Jesus says that we shouldn't do. So we can fulfill a legal obligation there, and that's probably the case that the situation that might get us closest to, if we're not thinking about it, to falling to this, to the temptation to swear when we're told to do so in a court of law. But we're not to do it at all. Jesus says that. Don't swear not at all. And is it necessary that he would say anything beyond that? I mean, would the commandment be valid if he said swear not at all and there was just a period there and nothing else? Would we need anything else, or should we? No, but people being people, and the Lord knows man and knows how people work, he goes further and gives examples. Swear not at all. He says, neither by heaven. Why not swear by heaven? Well, he says, that's God's throne. He says, nor by the earth. Why not? That's God's footstool. What's the point about both of those, whether heaven or earth? Whose is it? God's. So all this goes back to the authority of God, who's the only one that has authority. And this is the real point here. And why not to do it? Neither by Jerusalem, he says, for it is the city of the great king. Who is that? The one who was speaking these words, who was sent by the Father. So this all goes back to and connects to God. He says, and then don't swear by your own head. Why not? It's really the same reason. I mean, who made our head? Who does it belong to? And who has control over it? God. If we're actually swearing an oath by anyone or anything, what are we really saying? What is behind that oath? That we have some kind of authority or control, isn't it? That's the real problem with it. What authority or control do we actually have? We don't. What are we? What does God call us? Well, for a place where he, going back to that faithfulness situation that we were talking about and that quality. 1 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 2. Moreover, it is required in stewards that a man be found faithful. I mean, what are we but stewards? Is there anything that we have that is purely our own? And 1 Corinthians, Chapter 4, verse 2. Chapter 4, verse 7 informs us that nothing that we have is actually our own. Everything we have has been given to us. What do we have that wasn't given to us? What about our head and our hairs on it? Our bodies? Whatever it is that we have, our abilities, whatever possessions we have. Now, we have to do certain things. We do have to work, but the ability to work, the jobs that we have that bring an income, all of it is from God. So what do we actually have that was not given to us, that is ours and belongs to us on our own, that we did ourselves without God? Nothing. And what control do we have over anything? Nothing. So to swear an oath by anybody or anything is it's really false, because it is really saying that we have some kind of authority and control to make something happen. We've already seen this subject really brought up in the previous chapter in our study of the book of James, didn't we? When he was telling us how to speak in regard to what we're going to be doing. Remember James chapter 4, verse 13, when he says, "Go to now, ye that say, today or tomorrow we will go into such a city and continue there a year, and buy and sell and get gain, whereas you know not what shall be on the morrow. For what is your life? It is even a vapor that appeareth for a little time and then vanisheth away. For that you ought to say, if the Lord will, we shall live and do this or that." That principle that he taught there, that we've already studied about, it's based on the fact that we don't have any control. We can't make ourselves live. We don't have the power to keep ourselves alive. We can't will ourselves to be alive for the rest of tonight or tomorrow. If it's God's will to take our life tonight, what in the world can we do to change that? What power do we have? What power does any man have to change that? When God has determined that's our time, what's going to happen? That's it. And if it's not God's will, if we have our intention to go somewhere and do something tomorrow, which most of us will have a plan. We already have something probably planned for tomorrow, to go to work or whatever. Well, if it's not God's will that we safely get there, I mean, has it ever happened to any one of us in this room that we had our plan to go a certain place and we didn't make it there because something happened? Something happened that we did not plan for at all, that we did not foresee, that was beyond our control. I mean, what does all that teach us? We don't have any control. So it's only if the Lord wills that we're going to be alive or be able to do whatever it is that we're planning to do. And we need to speak in those terms. We need to credit God, the one and only one who has the authority and the control over anything and everything. So from that standpoint, to say I'm going to go here tomorrow and do this or do that, or to swear that I'm going to do something or not do something, aren't those pretty similar? with or without the oath, it's still a statement that says we have, by our mouths, we are speaking in a manner that is giving ourselves credit for having authority and control that we don't possess. So Jesus is clear on that in his teaching there, and then summed it up in Matthew 5, after telling us in verse 36, don't swear by our head because we cannot make one hair white or black. I'm proof of that. This is not a dye job. It turned white. It happened. Without my control, I had nothing to do with it. I didn't have anything to do with the color it was before it turned gray, and I wasn't. Most of you were in here. That some of you younger ones, like Samuel back there and Kayla and Astra, they probably think I was born with gray hair. But quite a few of you in this room knew me back before that. So, but anyway, I mean, we don't have any control over those things. What happens? Whether we have hair at all. I mean, that's beyond our power, isn't it? The Lord knows every hair on our head, but he's the one that has power over all that, and so he says not to swear by our head for that reason, because we don't have any control over that. And to swear an oath that we're going to do something by whatever it is that we might swear by is it's really a boast, just like to say we're going to live or go here and to this city and buy and sell and get gain, be there for a year or however long. I mean, that's a boast. That's the word he uses after the end of that. All such boasting is evil. Well, it's also a boast to swear. And Jesus tells us not to do it. He sums it up in verse 37, though. He says, but let your communication be. So this is why if we're adding to swear to do something, to swear by something, we're already adding extra words. And the more we speak, the more likely it is that we're going to get ourselves in trouble, isn't it? And when we start adding any extras in, as far as what our mouth is saying, the more we say... also, what happens in people that end up in courts of law where they have been warned that whatever they say, they have a right to remain silent, but if they say something, it can and will be used against them in a court of law. Well, if we say something, God is the witness, and he's going to hold us accountable for our words. So this is the principle that Jesus teaches in Matthew 5:37, for us to let our communication be yes, yes, or no, no. So instead of swearing to do something or swearing not to do something, we need to say yes or no to it. And if it has anything to do with our intentions for the future, we need to say, as James 4 teaches us, if the Lord wills, we will or will not do whatever it is. But we need to say, keep it to yes and no. And if the Lord wills, and if we add anything to that, what happens? Whatsoever is more than these cometh of evil. The same principle that Jesus also teaches in Matthew chapter 12, verses 34 to 37. Matthew 12, 34 to 37. Says, O generation of vipers, how can you, being evil, speak good things? For out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaketh. A good man out of the good treasure of the heart bringeth forth good things, and an evil man out of the evil treasure bringeth forth evil things. But I say unto you that every idle word that men shall speak, they shall give account thereof in the day of judgment. For by thy words thou shalt be justified, and by thy words thou shalt be condemned. So how much of our eternity and where we spend it is going to end up being based on how we used our tongues? Yeah, I mean, that's going to have a lot to do with where we spend eternity. Our tongues are going to have a lot to do with that. Isn't that also what James 3 was teaching? That power that's in that that little member. Of course, it's because of what's in our hearts. It's from the abundance of the heart our mouth is speaking. So it's ultimately what's there in the heart that will cause us to be condemned if we if we're uttering anything from that. But if we are swift to hear and slow to speak, like James 1 and verse 19 commands us, then is there safety in that? I mean, just think of how much we think of James 3 as being the chapter on the tongue, which that is really the central subject of the chapter. But that's not the only place in the book of James where we find teachings about the tongue. I mean, chapter 1, verse 19, where he says, be swift to hear and slow to speak and slow to wrath. And then at the end of the chapter, verse 26, when he's teaching us to be not hearers only, but doers of the word, how much must we do? What does he say will make our religion vain if we don't bridle our tongues? Chapter 3, we know we have that, all the teachings that are there on the tongue in that. And then we looked at chapter 4 with what he teaches about, and that's just there are other passages in James. There's other chapters, but chapter 4, I mean, teaches us a lot there. A very important point that we just read again a moment ago about how we speak in terms of what we're going to do or not do, and that it needs to be, if the Lord wills, we shall live or do this or that. And then here we are in chapter 5 with this reminder of Christ's teaching and repeating it, not to swear. But then he says, above all things, and when we read that, what Jesus said there, Matthew 5:37, when we're saying more than yes, yes, and no, no, it's going to come of evil. And then in Matthew 12, he warns us about how we're going to be judged by every idle word that our mouth speaks, and we're either going to be justified or condemned based on our words. So back in the book of James, in chapter 5, verse 12, I think I've said 13 a couple of times, but anyway, it's verse 12. But above all things, my brethren, swear not, neither by heaven, neither by the earth, neither by any other oath. Exactly what Jesus taught there that we read in Matthew 5. But let your yea be yea and your nay, nay, lest you fall into condemnation. Exactly what Jesus taught in Matthew 5. And then we've also seen what he also said and taught in Matthew 12 about that, which ties into James 3. So how does this relate to above all things, like he says in those other couple of places in Colossians 3, verse 14, when the context is the purpose that God has for us. And he says, and above all these things, put on charity, which is the bond of perfectness. Put on love, which is the bond of perfectness, completeness. Or 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 8, when he also says, above all things, have fervent charity among yourselves, for charity shall cover the multitude of sins. I mean, both of those places are emphasizing the love of God that we need to have. If we love one another, what does James? What does 1 John 4:12 say? If we love one another, his love will be perfected in us. Can we have the love of God perfected in us, completed in us, without loving one another? I mean, how many of the parts of God's love is going to apply or be directed towards someone else? Kindness, mercy, forbearance, forgiveness. I mean, how many of those parts of the nature of God are going to have to be shown or displayed towards others, especially our brethren? And that's why the second greatest commandment is the second greatest commandment. I mean, how much of the teachings that the Lord gives is going to be connected to our loving one another? And so that's what we see in 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 8, for having fervent love one toward another. We can't have God's love perfected in us if we don't do that. And we need to, above all things, do that, which fits right in with the teaching in Colossians 3:14, to put on love, which is the bond of perfectness. Well, James 3 verse 2 tells us that in many things we offend all. If any man offend not in word, the same is a perfect man and able also to bridle the whole body. Is there a connection between having our tongues bridled and having God's love completed in us? I mean, he says when we have our, to not have our tongues bridled will make our religion vain, James 1:26. But James 3 verse 2 shows us if we do that, we're able also to bridle the whole body, showing us how the tongue is the most difficult member we have to bring under control. But if we do that and we are doing what God has taught to the point where we are bridling our tongues and not causing any to stumble by our words, not causing any to fall, then he says, then we are spiritually the complete man and able to bridle the whole body. So when he says above all things not to swear, it's connected to that keeping our tongue. It's a function of keeping our tongues bridled, isn't it? Just like the end of chapter 4 about saying if the Lord wills, we shall live or do this or that. Not to swear, but to keep our yes, yes, and our no, no, lest we fall into condemnation. So it is an application of that principle we've already seen. It is directly connected to the ultimate purpose of God in that we must keep his word in order to have his love perfected in us, 1 John 2:5. And without the obedience to that commandment to bridle our tongues, we will end up being condemned. Having practiced a vain religion. So this does tie into the other places when he says above all things. So if we can see that connection, then we are doing well and understanding that. Verse 13, James chapter 5, verse 13. This will extend into verse 14. With some questions that he asks of us, and then based upon our answer to it, this is kind of what I do in my other line of work. Asking patients, well, do you have this problem or have that problem? Based on the answer, yes or no, it has something to do with what I might prescribe them. But here the Lord is asking us questions. Verse 13 says, is any among you afflicted? Let him pray. Is any merry? Let him sing psalms. Is any sick among you? Let him call for the elders of the church and let them pray over him, anointing him with oil in the name of the Lord. We have three different questions in those two verses pertaining to what situation or state we might be in. And at some point in time, I mean, this whatever we answer that question right now, that doesn't mean it's going to be the permanent answer to that question. We're going to be able to say yes to all of those questions at some point. Or, I mean, certainly we have in our past many times had all of those situations. I mean, we've all been afflicted. That's something that is common to us when we follow Christ. These are afflictions for righteousness' sake in context, most certainly. That's what so much of James 5 has been about, beginning with verse 6. So he's clearly in the context of this very chapter talking about afflictions that we suffer for righteousness' sake? Is any marrying? Well, are there going to be times when we're not under affliction? I mean, are we 100% of our time going to be suffering affliction? Is our faith going to be tried nonstop? What did we see in chapter 4? If we resist the devil, what does he say to do that for? He will what? If we resist him? Flee. So is there relief from temptation? In chapter 1, told us to, in verse 2, to count it all joy when we fall into diverse temptations, knowing this, that the trying of your faith worketh patience. And we, in the next verse, verse 4, let patience have her perfect work, that you may be perfect and entire, wanting nothing. So when we are in that state, he says, count it all joy because with knowing what it's going to produce in us. But as we're being tempted then and resist and overcome those temptations, does the Lord give us relief, respite from those trials? The devil's going to flee. Does he flee forever and stay gone forever? Or does he come back? I mean, he's going to come back. And we're going to have more trials on our faith. So there's going to be periods where we have the trials, the afflictions, and the temptations that go with that. There are going to be the times when we're given relief from that. There are going to be times when we are very joyful. I mean, our lives on this earth are not 100% filled with misery and affliction. Does God give us good things? And he brings joy in all of our lives. He's very good to us. He gives us many reasons to rejoice. And rejoice in the Lord always. And again, I say rejoice. He states that in Philippians, the book of Philippians, more than once. But we have that. We're going to have those times, particularly when we're joyful for something. What does he tell all of us to do with each other, whether weeping or rejoicing? We're to weep with those who weep, rejoice with those who are rejoicing. We have times of both, don't we? We also have times when we're sick. I mean, we can all relate to that. And I mean, that's the situation for a lot of people right now, too. So physically, we're also going to see some attention given to spiritual sickness as we go forward and towards the end of this chapter, because sickness can be either. But we know that we have physical ailments from time to time, some of them we carry with us, might be carrying with us pretty much all along what we call chronic, where it just doesn't entirely go away at all. But there are times when we're more well or more sick. So these situations that he's bringing up there, whether afflicted, merry, or sick, I mean, these are common states or situations that we're going to be in numerous times in our lives. And so he's teaching us some things to do based on whatever state, whichever of those states we might be in. Without going into the in-depth in what he says to do in all of those things right now, there is a goal that we need to have through all of it, and this is what the Apostle Paul was striving for. Sunday morning we were looking at the example of the Apostle Paul that we need to follow, and the book of Philippians is one of those books in chapter 3 where he tells us to follow the example of Paul. Philippians 3:17 says, "Brethren, be followers together of me, and mark them which walk so as you have us for an example." Well, in Philippians 4, we can see what one of the goals that Paul had and what he had achieved, what he had learned. Now, if you have to learn something, Is it second nature? Does it come naturally? Are we born with this, or is this something that we have to come to understand, to learn it, and then put it into practice. Yeah, it's not something that comes naturally or easily. But in Philippians chapter 4, actually going back to verse 6, he says, "Be careful for nothing, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known unto God." So this is something we want to also look at with that James 5 verse 13. Is any afflicted? He says, let him pray. Well, he says here in verse 6 to be careful for nothing, and that word careful is really means to be anxious about things, and we shouldn't be, knowing that God's working all things together for our good. He's in control of all things. He's working it. Everything after the counsel of his own will. There's so many great promises we have from God, and he's never going to leave us nor forsake us. With all of that, whatever the situation is, if we're in affliction, if we're sick or anything, if it's anything bad going on in our lives, do we need to be fretting over it? Doesn't mean it's not a concern or something that brings temptation with it, but he tells us what to do here. We do need to pray. We need to thank God for what he's done. We need to make our request known to him. So if we need something, we need to ask him, because he's able to do it. And he says in verse 7, "And the peace of God which passeth all understanding shall keep your hearts and minds through Christ Jesus. Finally, brethren, whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are honest, whatsoever things are just, whatsoever things are pure, whatsoever things are lovely, whatsoever things are of good report, if there be any virtue and if there be any praise, think on these things." A lot of good practical teaching in these verses, what to occupy our minds with in terms of what we should be thinking about. Verse 9 then says, "Those things which ye have both learned and received and heard and seen in me, do. And the God of peace shall be with you." So again, we need to follow that example of Paul. And he says in verse 10, so what would be Paul's example in this context of Philippians 4? Well, did Paul ever have any afflictions or anything ever go wrong for him? Did he ever face temptation? Of course he did. And he says in verse 10, "But I rejoiced in the Lord greatly that now at the last your care of me hath flourished again, wherein you were also careful but lacked opportunity." And this is, and there's some more about it in verses that follow this, but the context there is about the financial assistance or provision of physical needs that the brethren in Philippi and the rest of Macedonia. So you had the churches at Philippi and Berea and Thessalonica. Those were congregations that from the very beginning after on Paul's second missionary journey, when he was used by God to establish those churches by preaching the gospel there, then immediately after that, everywhere that Paul went from then on, they sent to him things to help with his physical needs. Paul made tents, so he did work with his own hands for things that he needed, but he also had brethren that were helping him with his physical needs, and he was thankful for that. He's referring here to some hindrance where they had not been able to do that for a time. Now they are again. So was it always the same? Did Paul always have the same as far as what his physical provisions? Was it always the same amount? Is it for us? Are there some times that get tougher than others for us as far as our finances or physical or material goods that we have? I mean, yes, there's going to be ups and downs, as we know. That happens through life. It happened to Paul. Verse 11, here's the key. He says, not that I speak in respect of want, which is lack. He says, for I have learned in whatsoever state I am, therewith to be content. I know both how to be abased, and I know how to abound. Everywhere and in all things I am instructed both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. I can do all things through Christ, which strengtheneth me. So Paul learned to be content in whatever state he was in. So whether it was he was abounding or whether he was lacking, whether it was an up or a down, Paul learned to be content either way. Did he let himself get carried away with, because when, if we get, if things are going really well, if we're flourishing in some manner, I mean, that brings its own set of temptations, doesn't it? We could become Laodiceans and think that we don't need anything. Or get lifted up in pride thinking we did something. We really accomplished something. We really did something good there. Look at what I did. And so there's its own set of temptations with abounding, flourishing, but also, of course, if we're lacking. But Paul learned to be content in whatever state he was in. And we need to learn the same thing. So whether we are afflicted, whether we are merry, whether we are sick, there are certain things God says, here are things to do in those situations. But through it all, we do need to learn to be content in each of those states and in all of those states, and remain steadfast and unmovable in serving God, whatever the circumstance that we may be in. We will continue, Lord willing, with our study here in verses 13 and 14 of James chapter 5 next Wednesday night, Lord willing. But we'll close here now for this evening.